Okay, let's unpack this.
We are diving deep today into something, well, pretty remarkable. It's not just an album we're looking at, it's a fully realized narrative cycle. 14 songs that tell one complete story.
A really intense story. Our mission for this deep dive is to trace that arc. We're going to look at how these 14 tracks work together step by step to chronicle the breakdown of a marriage.
And it is step by step. It starts with a physical separation, moves through this attempt at an open relationship, and then just completely collapses into betrayal, anxiety, and finally a kind of recovery.
So for you listening, think of this as a roadmap. We're guiding you through a really complex emotional journey, and we'll be highlighting these huge themes along the way: betrayal, setting boundaries, what happens when they break.
And also the psychological cost of compromise. That's a huge one here. Because the sequence is so important, we're going to follow the sources exactly in order, one by one, to see how the story unfolds.
All right, let's get into it. The story begins with the first track, West End Girl. And what's so striking is how quickly it establishes not just a relationship, but a very specific lifestyle.
Oh, absolutely. A high-status, wealthy New York life. The source uses these materialistic details almost like stage directions, you know?
Yeah, they move into a nice little rental, but that's not enough.
Right. Almost immediately, they're looking at houses with 4 or 5 floors. It's this constant escalation that culminates in buying a brownstone with a good mortgage.
It's not just showing that they're rich. It's about building a fortress of success. And that detail about Billy Cotton got sorted, that
Yeah.
really locks it in.
It's such a specific signifier, isn't it? For anyone who knows luxury interior design, that's not just furniture, that's a statement. This life is curated, it's high-end, it's very expensive.
It's a marriage that's built on a certain aesthetic, a certain expectation of success.
And within that setting, the power dynamic is clear from the get-go, and it's not equal.
No, the husband is the provider. He's the one pushing it forward, and the narrator says, pretty explicitly, that this makes her feel a bit awkward.
So even in all this success, there's this undercurrent of imbalance. Her security, her lifestyle, it's all flowing from him. She recognizes that he's the one with the economic power.
That feeling of being awkward, it's like a little crack in the foundation, isn't it? It suggests the whole thing is built on his terms.
Exactly, which is why it's so disruptive when her own career suddenly takes off.
She gets a lead role in a play, a huge opportunity, but it means moving back to London.
And that's the inciting incident for the entire story. Her success, something that is hers alone, forces a physical separation.
And his reaction when she tells him this good news is the first huge red flag.
It's fascinating. The source says his demeanor started to change. Any initial enthusiasm just sours.
He goes from supportive partner to something else entirely. Suspicious, controlling.
Yes, he makes this demand that she audition for him, which, as she points out, is completely deranged.
It's so strange. She already has the part. So what is that about? Is it just jealousy?
I think it's deeper. It's about reasserting control. Her success is independent of him, and he can't handle that. So by demanding an audition, he's trying to make her success conditional on his approval.
He's trying to pull her back into the dynamic where he's in charge.
Exactly. He's saying, "This great thing you achieved, it's not real until I say it is." It's incredibly undermining.
And crucially, she sees it's very strange, but she ignores him. She goes anyway.
And that one act of resistance, choosing her career over his control, is what sets everything in motion.
It forces the separation, and that distance is what allows the central conflict to really begin. The song ends with her completely alone.
Yeah, in London, in a hotel room, she's now a West End girl. That physical distance creates a vacuum in the relationship.
A vacuum that he is very clearly ready to fill.
Which brings us straight into the next source, ruminating, where we just plunge from that geographical distance into a full-blown emotional collapse.
It's immediate. The effect of this separation and what seems to be a new arrangement between them just hits her like a truck.
The anxiety is so physical. The source mentions 4 a.m. being in fight or flight. She's up all night. It's not just sadness. Her body is in crisis mode.
And the torment isn't vague, is it? It's centered on one specific awful image.
Right. She can't shake the image of her naked on top of you. It's this intrusive thought, this mental picture of his betrayal that she can't escape. It's driving her to dissociation.
And in the middle of that pain, she tries to reclaim some power by just repeating, "You're mine, 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 mine."
It's a desperate assertion of ownership. But it's immediately followed by her projecting all her anger onto the other woman. You make me hate her.
Which is such a classic response, isn't it? Focus the rage on the rival, not the partner who actually broke the trust.
It's a defense mechanism. And it's right here, in the middle of her crisis, that we get what the source calls the crucial line. This is where the open marriage concept is actually put into words.
And the line is, if it has to happen, baby, do you want to know? Wow.
It's a masterclass in emotional manipulation. It's so cruel.
In what way? What's it doing psychologically?
Well, two things at once. First, it frames his infidelity as an inevitability if it has to happen. Like, it's a force of nature, not a choice he's making.
He's taking all his personal responsibility out of the equation.
Completely. And second, by asking, do you want to know? He dumps the entire emotional burden on her.
She has to choose. Either know the awful details or live with the torture of not knowing.
Exactly. Either way, she's now responsible for managing the fallout of his actions. It's a brilliant, terrible move.
And her response is just, I don't know, I don't know. She's completely paralyzed.
So this arrangement isn't born from some mutual healthy decision. It's born from her fear and his manipulation. Mm-hmm. And that sends her spiraling into these obsessive questions.
Right. Trying to figure out the rules. Did you kiss her on the lips and look into her eyes?
She's trying to define the boundaries of intimacy, trying to convince herself that if it's just physical, maybe the marriage is still safe. She needs him to tell her she's still your number one.
She's trying to build a fence around a fire that's already burning.
That's a great way to put it. And that feeling of being trapped leads us right into the next source, sleepwalking.
Yeah, this one is all about emotional neglect. The central idea is, you won't love me, you won't leave me.
He's emotionally checked out, but he's also still so needy. He needs her there as an anchor, but he's not giving her anything back. She's stuck.
And worse, he's actively making it her fault. The source points to gaslighting here.
He starts making the infidelity my fault. The key question he asks is, why aren't we fucking baby?
So he's flipping it. He's suggesting that her emotional withdrawal, which is a reaction to what he's doing, is actually the cause of it.
Precisely. He makes her believe the disconnect was me in my head and that it had nothing to do with them girls in your bed. He's making her question her own reality.
It's classic blame shifting. And she seems to recognize how absurd it is, but she's still trying to fix it.
She is. She's sleepwalking through it, but she's so desperate to keep the marriage that she gets in this point of, well, total self-destruction.
This is the part where she offers to be his whore, just to preserve all of your fantasies by acting them out with him. It's a really painful moment.
It's the ultimate act of people-pleasing. She's completely abandoned her own identity in this last-ditch effort to become what she thinks he wants.
If she can just be the one to fulfill these fantasies, maybe she can eliminate the competition.
She's trading her self-respect for what she hopes is security, but the arrangement has already failed. It's just leading her further down this dark path.
And then that path leads to a very concrete discovery. This is where we get to source 04, tennis.
Yes. The abstract anxiety is about to become a very real, specific betrayal. The husband comes home for the first time in weeks.
And she's still trying, making his favorite dinner, but he's just cold, detached.
She's trying to rationalize it, right? Telling herself he's just jet lagged.
Clinging to any normal explanation she can find.
But that illusion is shattered by technology, as it so often is.
The discovery is so quick. He shows her a photo on Instagram, and in that split second before he snatches the phone back, she reads a text.
A text about playing tennis. And she knows instantly that this is different. This is not part of the deal.
Right. She says it herself. If it was just sex, I wouldn't be jealous. That is the key.
It absolutely is. So playing tennis, what does that imply? It implies companionship, a shared activity, time spent together.
It implies a mini relationship. And the real pain for her is that he's giving someone else the one thing he won't give her, his time and attention. You won't play with me.
He's emotionally investing elsewhere, and that's the rule that has been broken. The arrangement was meant to be purely physical, disposable. This is not disposable.
And the person involved now has a name. It's not just her anymore.
No. Now it's who's Madeline.
Yeah.
The threat is real. It's specific. And the narrator delivers that devastating line. You move the goalposts, you've broken the rules.
She realizes her attempt to accommodate this whole situation was just taken for a fool. The contract she was trying so hard to honor, he just ignored it.
Which sets up the next track, Madeline, Perfectly. This one is like a forensic investigation into the broken contract.
It's structured almost like she's writing an email or a text to Madeline herself.
Right. And she starts by trying to take the blame off Madeline, saying, none of this is your fault.
Is that genuine, do you think? Or is it a tactic?
I think it's mostly tactical. By positioning them both as victims of his deceit, she's hoping to get information. She says she can't trust anything he says anymore.
She needs an ally, even if it's a reluctant one. And then she just lays out the rules of the arrangement. It's so clinical.
It is. We had an arrangement. The rules were, be discreet, there had to be payment, and the big one, it had to be with strangers.
And Madeline is not a stranger.
But you're not a stranger, Madeline. That's the core violation. Madeline represents a sustained connection, which is exactly what the rules were designed to prevent.
And then she reveals the lies he's been telling Madeline. That the marriage has only ever been about sex, that he has full consent.
He's managing two separate narratives, lying to both of them to keep his double life going. And you see the narrator's own insecurities just pour out.
Speculating that he's telling Madeline she's gotten old, gotten ugly, and that awful fear that he might have brought her into their home.
I'm not convinced that he didn't fuck you in our house. The betrayal has now become a territorial invasion.
And the track seems to end with Madeline's actual response.
It does, and it's very revealing. She says she's sorry for the narrator's pain, and she confirms he claimed to have full consent.
But the real kicker is her warning, isn't it?
Yes. She says, I have my own feelings about dishonesty. This confirms he was lying to Madeline, too. It paints him as the sole architect of all this deception.
And that confirmation is really the final piece of evidence she needs, which sends her straight into the crash.
Exactly. We hit Sorso 6, relapse, the betrayal is confirmed, and the emotional bottom just falls out.
It's an immediate crisis. The first line is, I need a drink, I need a Valium.
Total loss of control. She's reaching for anything that will numb the pain. The imagery is all about the loss of stability. The ground is gone beneath me.
You pulled the safety net. She lists everything she sacrificed for this marriage, moving across an ocean, leaving her friends. Only for the foundation to be shattered.
And this is where that identity conflict really comes to a head. The person she was trying to be versus how she actually feels.
I tried to be your modern wife.
But the child in me protests. The rational, accommodating adult has just been overwhelmed by raw, primal hurt.
And the stakes feel so high, she keeps repeating, if I relapse, I know I stand to lose it all.
It suggests this isn't just about emotional pain. His actions are threatening her sobriety, her mental health, everything. And she feels this pressure to be an example for her daughters.
The crisis pushes her to take action, which brings us to Sorso 7, Pussy Palace.
Right. She tries to take back some control. She tells him, don't come home, and goes to his apartment to drop off his stuff.
An apartment she thought was his dojo. Something healthy for self-improvement.
A completely benign idea.
Yeah.
But what she finds there, it just reveals the true scale of the deception. It's not a dojo. It's a pussy palace.
This is the moment the betrayal goes from being about lies and emotions to being about cold, hard, physical evidence.
And the evidence is overwhelming. It's so specific. A shoebox full of handwritten letters from brokenhearted women.
That detail is chilling. It proves this isn't new. This is a pattern. He's a serial offender.
A trophy case of his past betrayals. Then there's the long black hair, the Dwayne Reed bag full of sex toys, lube, and
hundreds of Trojans.
The sheer quantity of it. It's not casual. It's industrial. It shatters any remaining illusions she might have had.
And it leads her to this first real attempt at a diagnosis.
Yes. For the first time, she looks at the evidence and asks, so am I looking at a sex addict? She's starting to frame his behavior as a pathology, not just a moral failing.
And she's left with this devastating question. How'd I get caught up in your double life?
That investigation continues in the next source, 4chan Stan. She's back in the marital home, but she's still digging.
She finds a Bergdorf's receipt, an expensive shopping trip that happened in May while she was in London.
The timing is crucial. It shows he started courting someone new the second she was gone. The separation was the opportunity, not the cause.
And it seems like this new woman might be on another level. She starts wondering, what is she famous?
The contempt really comes through here. The grief starts turning into this very modern, scathing anger. She calls him a sad, sad man, and of course, a 4chan stan.
We should probably explain that reference. What does 4chan stan mean in this context?
A stan is an obsessive fan, and linking it to 4chan connects it to this whole online world of insecurity, misogyny, and entitlement. She's basically calling him a pathetic, insecure coward who worships famous women from afar.
An attack on his whole character. And then she has this final cynical realization about their marriage.
That it was all just a marriage of convenience. He was using the respectability of being married to her to make himself seem more stable and attractive to other women.
She wasn't his partner. She was his cover story.
A prop in his double life. And that realization that she was just being used leads her to really start examining her own role in all of this.
Which brings us to non-monogamy. This is her looking back and trying to understand why she agreed to any of it.
And she's brutally honest. I don't want to fuck with anyone else. I know that's all you want to do. She only compromised because I don't want to lose you.
It was all based on fear.
Pure fear of abandonment. She details all the sacrifices she made, changing her immigration status, building this palace on the perfect street, only to feel like a complete failure.
And she identifies that core psychological pattern. For some reason, I revert to people-pleasing.
That's the key. And it explains the title, I'll Be Your Non-Monogamy.
It's such a brilliant, painful term.
It is. It combines the failed arrangement, non-monogamy, with the role she was forced into, this nurturing, forgiving, maternal figure, the mummy.
While all this is going on, she's already looking at dating apps. Tinder, Hinger, The Dream is Dead, and she's looking for an escape hatch.
And then you have that specialist Moss feature, which adds this cold, cynical, outside perspective.
Right. Questioning if she's just a token in his life, if the whole thing is just for promotion.
It reinforces her deepest fears that their relationship was never genuine to begin with, which leads directly into just enough.
The anxiety is back, but this time it's not based on suspicion. It's based on facts. And her deepest fear is now clear.
I think you're in love with somebody else.
She realizes he's deliberately keeping her in the dark, telling her it's for her own good, that it's kind, but it's actually making her lose her mind.
It's a specific manipulation strategy. The title says it all. You give me just enough hope to hold on to nothing.
Just enough to keep her from leaving, but not enough to give her any real security.
And the strain is becoming physical. This part is just brutal. She looks in the mirror and feels so drawn, so old.
And she's booked myself a facelift.
It's the externalization of her internal breakdown. She's been made to feel that her appearance is the problem. So she's trying to physically change herself to win back his affection. It's heartbreaking.
And her fears just keep escalating beyond infidelity into these huge life-altering possibilities.
Why are we here talking about vasectomies? And then the ultimate fear, did you get someone pregnant? Someone who isn't me?
The stakes just went from a broken heart to a potentially secret parallel family. It's terrifying.
It's the absolute peak of her psychological torment. And that torment leads to one final desperate coping mechanism in Dallas Major.
Since her real identity has been shattered, she creates a new one.
An online alter ego, Dallas Major. She's coming out to play, and she's there for one reason, validation.
This persona, Dallas, is everything the narrator feels she isn't right now. Confident, assertive, in control.
And through this persona, she can admit the painful truths. I used to be quite famous, and my marriage has been open since my husband went astray. It's a way to tell her story without having to own the shame of it directly.
But the mask keeps slipping, doesn't it?
It's paper thin. The real feeling keeps breaking through. I hate it here. This whole exercise in seeking validation is just making her more miserable. She's doing it because she's terrified of failure.
Dallas Major is her last attempt to play by his rules, to prove she can be this non-monogamous, desirable person. And it's a complete failure.
Which brings us to the final section. The shift from desperation to taking back control. It starts with Source 12, beg for me.
This is her final plea, her ultimatum.
And it comes from a place of embarrassment and shame. She has been completely torn down, and the one thing she needs from him is to show that he actually wants her.
But he's just so indifferent, which is insane given everything he's done. Her friends are even telling her he's deranged.
So she spells out exactly what she needs. To be held, special, unusual, beautiful. She needs him to rebuild her self-worth with his words, his actions.
And it all boils down to that one repeated question. Yeah.
Why won't you beg for me? If you want me to stay, love endlessly. It's the final test. If he can't show that level of desperate love, it's over.
And we can assume he doesn't, because the next track, Let You Win, is a complete tonal shift.
A seismic shift. This is where she stops asking him for anything and starts taking back her own dignity. She reclaims the narrative.
She makes this very pragmatic, very powerful decision to protect his reputation. I'm protecting you from your secrets.
But it's not for his sake. It's for hers. By managing the narrative, she can ensure a cleaner exit for herself and, importantly, for her children. Don't tell the children the truth would be brutal.
And then comes the most important line of her recovery.
I will not absorb your shame. It's you who put me through this. After all that self-blame and people-pleasing, she finally draws the line. The shame is his, not hers.
She realizes she can walk out with my dignity, even if it means telling a lie. She agrees the public story will be that the ending was mutual.
She's willing to shoulder all of the pain of that lie to secure her freedom. But she's done carrying his sins. You've taken everything, she says. And now she's leaving.
Which sets the stage for the final track, the psychological conclusion to the whole story, Fruity Loop.
This is her final diagnosis. It's detached, it's clinical, it's clear.
She sees him for what he is. A little boy looking for his mummy. Someone who can't really do attachment.
And that explains everything. The serial cheating, the constant need for validation. He's not looking for a partner. He's looking for a revolving door of maternal figures.
And she turns that same analytical lens on herself. This is so important.
It is. She recognizes her own pattern. I'm just a little girl looking for a daddy. She sees that they were locked in this destructive, complementary dynamic.
And she admits the futility of it. Thought that we could break the cycle. Thought that I could keep you happy.
And then the final liberating statement of the entire narrative cycle. It reverses every moment of gaslighting and self-doubt.
It's not me, it's you.
That's her freedom. She realizes he's stuck in a pattern he can't escape. It's what you've always done. It's what you'll do forever till you die. It's true.
He's stuck in his fruity loop.
And by seeing that, by truly understanding that his behavior is a compulsion, she knows there was nothing I could do to change it. And that is how she finally gets free.
So what does this all mean when we look back across the entire narrative?
Well, as a piece of storytelling, this 14-song cycle is just incredibly effective. It's so detailed, so tightly constructed. The little things, the Billy Cotton, the Bergdorf receipt, that shoebox of letters, they make the whole emotional drama feel so real.
And because the rules of the arrangement were laid out so clearly back in Madeline, the betrayal feels so much more calculated and impactful. It's not just cheating. It's a breach of a very specific contract.
And the chronological flow is just perfect. It maps a real emotional journey, doesn't it? From the separation and anxiety through the investigation and collapse to the final dignified exit and diagnosis, it's a complete arc.
We've touched on so many big themes here. How wealth can enable this kind of destructive behavior, the absolute failure of this attempt at non-monogamy, and this deep, painful exploration of people-pleasing.
The whole story is really about the journey from internalizing blame to externalizing a diagnosis, shifting the shame from herself to him.
It's an incredible story of finding your agency after being completely destroyed.
Right.
There's this one final contradiction at the end that we should leave you with.
Right. In Source 13, she makes the choice to lie, to say the ending was mutual, to protect his reputation for the sake of her kids. But then in Source 14, she finds her ultimate freedom in the realization that it's not me, it's you.
So the question to think about is this. If she makes that conscious choice to protect the person who betrayed her, even after she knows it was all his fault, does that compromise the dignity she fought so hard for? Is that final act of protecting his image truly a way to escape the cycle, or is it one last painful act from the non-monogamy?